call to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee for Wednesday, March 3rd, 2010. First item on the agenda is the minutes. Any corrections other than on the order of items, the minutes last meeting were approved before we took up Senator Preston Solon's bill. Minutes will reflect that. Correction, anything else? Senator Olsen moves that the minutes of the March 1st meeting be approved as corrected. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Senator Box, Senate File 2532. Senator Box, this is the second committee?
This is the second committee.
It's the second or third? Second committee?
Second.
Second committee. To the committee, and we're pleased to hear your bill.
Madam Chair, there are areas of the state that don't have good telecommunications access. One of them is in my district up in Cook County, and in Cook County, members, is really the tip of the state, north of Duluth, the tip that sticks out into Lake Superior. And their local provider is not interested in expanding broadband to the entire county. It simply is not cost-effective for them. I would argue they shouldn't do it. It's probably not a good use of their capital. It's an area that's only going to get served with broadband, probably similar to the way that rural electric co-ops brought power to rural areas because it wasn't feasible, so rural electric co-ops did that. So the county came to me and wanted to do a local option sales tax so that they could generate some revenue at the local level, and then they ran a referendum. One of the uses of their 1% local option sales tax was to extend fiber to the county. And so there were two ballot questions. One was to approve the 1% local option sales tax, and the second ballot question was to allow them to own and operate their own telephone exchange. And local option sales tax passed, but the telephone exchange piece, it also passed, but it didn't meet the threshold in law of requiring 65% of the voters to vote in support of it. And so they weren't able to operate the phone exchange, so the county came to me and wanted legislation so that they could operate their own exchange with just a majority vote. And that is what I tried to pass out of Senator Pretner Solon's committee. But the committee decided that this would be good statewide policy to make this change. So we're sitting here today with a statewide bill rather than one for Cook County, which is really was my original intent. I have with me, Madam Chair, Commissioner Fenwick, who can speak to kind of the specific circumstances of Cook County that brought us here. And then there is an amendment that I think we've worked out with the providers, the cable and telephone providers, that recognize the majority vote under some with some circumstances leading up to it relative to a feasibility study being done, a public hearing requirement, not committing additional revenues outside of what the exchange generates, that I think to my understanding there's some pretty broad support for. But maybe, Madam Chair, we could have Commissioner Fenwick speak to the Cook County issue, which is really what initially brought this issue to me at the Capitol.
Commissioner Fenwick, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Fenwick. I am a commissioner in Cook County. Thank you, Senator Bach. On this issue, I would like to speak to this briefly as I can and try to concentrate on what's relevant here. At its core, for our purposes, and I think for other counties like Cook, we're not unique, totally unique in our needs, this question devolves down to an economic sustainability issue. I can speak for Cook County. Cook County, as you may know, used to be a county where its revenues and its resources came from resources of the county, whether it been lumber, whether it been fur, those types of things. Over the years, Cook County has become almost totally dependent upon visitor money, tourist money, seasonal recreational people, and so forth. Our population is in the 5,500 area, total permanent residents. In the summer, that might balloon at any time in any one day up to perhaps 30,000 people. Because of that, because of the way our economy has gone, we recognize as a governmental unit that the sustainability of our economy there depends in great extent to the broadband issue. We have people who contemplate moving to Cook County who ask the realtor almost initially upon arriving, where within the county can I get broadband service that will get me 10 megabytes down and 10 megabytes up? And our honest answer, regrettably, is nowhere. And the foreseeable future, the answer would be nowhere. And the only types of business that we contemplate ever bringing to Cook County in the near future are those types of businesses that allow people to use what we would call the communication highway, the most important probably communication methods that we have. And we need to bring that forward. With that in mind, and we believe this as a governmental unit, if our obligation is to foster a sound, economic, sustainable process for our areas, we know that we need to bring broadband. We also know that the technology probably is what we would call the triple play, phone, internet, video. And if we're going to do that, whether it's us or any other entity that's going to bring it, it is absolutely necessary that phone revenues be used to help fund this. So when we ask the question in our referendum about being able to use telephone system, fully 25% of the projected revenues for our service would have come from those phone revenues. And, oh, by the way, they are the most profitable of the revenue sources that are there. So if this committee is looking for the answer as to whether or not that type of service and the need to be able to access readily those revenues from the phone service for local units of government, the answer is yes. Having said that, we hear a lot from the telcos and other private industries about fairness, leveling the playing field, and unfair competition. And I would like to say this from a county commissioner standpoint on those three levels. From the standpoint of fairness, it's really almost impossible to achieve. We in Cook County think it's unfair that 90% of our land is publicly owned. We in Cook County feel that it's unfair that the privates are unwilling to invest in the type of infrastructure that we need for the communications we need. We feel it's unfair that our infrastructure of copper wire is failing. And we feel it's unfair that compared to large metropolitan areas that have great access to this type of service, we only have 5,000 full-time residents. But that's simply a fact. And so we will operate underneath that fact and know that we have to move forward. In the area of a level playing field, it has often been said that allowing governmental units to have access to the revenues for phone systems and to use those revenues to fund a communications system would be unfair and unleveling the playing field. Speaking as a county commissioner, the playing field is not level now. We do not have the ability to be able to move forward and get the type of access to this product that the metropolitan area has. And because of the way the metropolitan area can provide profits to the telcos, that's where the systems are going to go in. So we would contend, and I would ask you to consider the fact that in order to level the playing field, the level playing field allows counties like Cook and others in our circumstance to get this type of service. And on the last issue, unfair competition. Of course, if a government goes into business and it doesn't have to pay taxes and all the other things that are brought forward, does that provide unfair competition? I would say yes in some circumstances. But I would think you'd have to be participating in an area where, A, there was competition, and in places like Cook County, for various reasons, a lot of the telcos choose not to compete. And the competition isn't there because there may only be in other places only one telco out there servicing an area, and that doesn't provide competition. So I would contend to you that where there are areas where there is no competition, where there are areas where people choose not to compete or even participate in the process, where there is a public that is willing to be involved financially in providing for what they think of for themselves is a needed service, where they are willing to tax themselves to be able to do that so that they compete in the world as we live in, that they should be allowed to do that. And in order for them to be allowed to do that, it is a necessity that they have access to the phone revenues that would drive this system. I stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there questions or comments for Commissioner Fenwick or Senator Bach? Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach had referred to an amendment, and I have the A4 amendment of this. I believe it's in your packet already. It's being distributed.
Senator Betzel, I believe it needs to be handed out.
Let me just describe generally the issue, and I'll have to let other people describe the specifics about it.
Let's get it before. Senator Betzel moves the A4 amendment. Well, now discussion.
Yeah, as Senator Bach indicated, when the bill was in the Utilities Committee, it was a narrow bill dealing with Cook County only, and it became a broader statewide bill. But by making it so, it brought in a whole host of other issues, which actually are within the jurisdiction of this particular committee. So I'll actually refer to Mr. McGowan and so forth to kind of walk through the amendment and others to describe, you know, how we can make this new referendum idea actually work.
Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, members, sub one of the amendment is the existing bill. That's what Senator Bach talked about, reducing that majority required from 65% to 50% when a municipality proposes to construct and operate its own telephone exchange where one already exists. Current law requires a 65% vote. This would reduce that to 50%. And also would include a county within the definition of municipality, so a county could do it as only a city can now do.
And that's the bill as it came to us.
That's the current bill, Madam Chair. Sub 2 is new language that provides essentially that the construction operation of the telephone exchange has to be financed through the use of revenues generated by the telephone exchange itself and not through general obligations of the city. It does allow, however, a sales tax that's in existence on the date of this act to be used for the construction operation of the facility. There's also a couple exceptions there at the bottom of page one of which is general fund revenues can be used for a feasibility study, and the revenue bonds can be sold to non-governmental investors. Sub 3 on page 2 requires a feasibility study before the referendum is held, and it lists the items that have to be included in the feasibility study. Requires a public hearing on that feasibility study no less than 60 days before the referendum, and requires the ballot question to list the total costs of the proposed project. Sub 4 limits a municipality from discriminating in favor of its own telephone exchange if they construct one. They can't grant more favorable conditions and terms with respect to public right-of-way, conduits, towers, telephone poles, and permitting fees. They have to treat both telephone exchanges equally. It also requires the municipality to approve or reject all permit applications within 30 days, that they can only deny a permit for cause, and if it's not approved within 30 days, it's not acted upon within 30 days, it's deemed approved. And then sub 5 is just a provision that provides that all contracts between the city or county and the providers are subject to the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, the competitive bidding requirements. So that's basically it, Madam Chair.
Senator Bach, would you like to speak to the amendment and what compromises it represents?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank the private providers for their effort in trying to find a way to allow communities that are underserved and aren't going to get served to be able to move forward with a majority vote. And I think these are some reasonable conditions to put on it, that the project stand on its own, and that the public be aware of what the cost is, and that there be a public meeting requirement, that the private providers have the same opportunities to use right-of-ways and those other circumstances. It seems to me that the private telcos have come a long way here. This is a bill that's actually, I think Senator Kelly had it. It's actually passed the Senate a couple of times, and the House has been unwilling to act on it. So I think with the private telcos coming as far as they have here, setting forth some conditions, recognizing that maybe there are some circumstances where a majority vote would be acceptable, I think it's coming a long way from where they've been previously. So I'm pleased that they've been willing to do that, and maybe the House this time will consider it and will actually get something done for areas that really are underserved and nobody has plans to serve them.
Questions for Well, it's a Betzel amendment, but obviously Senator Bach supports it. So if there are questions, let's direct them to Senator Bach. Senator Vickerman.
I'd like to ask the commissioner what he thinks of the changes. And I do that because I've got six in my area. My phone's ringing off the hook, support this bill. They got a grant from the federal government for about $13 million, and they're trying to get that in southern. So you have trouble in the north. I got trouble in the south. And I want to be sure that we're talking the same thing here. Could you respond?
Does it still work?
Senator, as you may well know, I just saw this language for the first time as we're sitting here right now. There are many restrictions in place that we already have to furnish a lot of information to telcos if indeed they want it. It's free information. It's public. And so I don't know how much more difficult they can make it. The feasibility study notion, I think, for the most part, from the standpoint of for the public, is probably a good idea. We wouldn't have gone forward without a feasibility study in our particular area, and I think that's important to sell the whole idea. Let me be honest. I think the notion of a public hearing to allow the telcos to be involved in the discussion publicly, no private industry would do that, allow a competitor to come in and speak publicly against their plan. But if that's what has to happen in a public setting, and maybe that wording can be changed, okay. I did say to Senator Bach before the meeting today that I think the solution for how funds should be used by the cities, and I'm only thinking off the top of my head here, doesn't necessarily come in the front end. I don't think it's particularly right to tie the hands of a public entity, a commissioner or a board or anything, to be able to go to their constituency and ask for revenue in the form of a tax to do what they want to do. I mean, after all, what would any type of local tax be good for? If the people want to fund something, by gosh, they should be able to do that. On the other hand, if we go and ask them to run a telephone business and a triple play option, I think some remedies in terms of how excess revenues from those things should be used, I think that's where maybe some regulatory issues should take place. I'm thinking of myself and other counties like myself, we don't want to go into this business for the purpose of making profits. And we just want to provide the service for our people. So I think I'd be very willing to be able to limit how we would use revenues from the business to make sure that it stayed with the business. That's my first reaction to it, and I'd really like to look it over more closely and then be able to react to it later. We're not alone. Cook County is not alone in its need, and you bring a good point forward. So we have to be, I think, from my standpoint, yes, I'm looking at this selfishly from what we need to do, but from the overall need for areas of the state that have low-density populations, I think this has to be looked at very closely.
Well, Madam Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I want to thank both of you for your work on it. I feel very comfortable with it, and I want to make the motion to send it on its way. I don't know where it goes from here, but it can be fine-tuned.
We have to act on the amendment first,
okay.
Senator Vickerman, that Senator Betzel has offered, and we're still in the process of discussing that. But when the time comes, I will call on you. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak specifically to the Betzel Amendment. I see that from Subdivision 2 on, all the taxpayer protections and the additional language, all good stuff that I agree with. I have a problem with the threshold, so I would like to have a discussion about this whole 65% majority. So in order to facilitate that discussion, I'd like to make an amendment to the amendment. Madam Chair, I'd like to propose that on line 14.14 of the Betzold Amendment, that we strike the new language of majority and reinstate the stricken language 65%.
Okay, we have the Betzold Amendment to the amendment. Senator Betzel.
Speak to the amendment.
I'm sorry, Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not saying necessarily that I'm right on this because I don't know of all of the situations and in particular areas of the state, but it sounds to me like Senator Bach had a modest proposal when he approached this with the legislature with Cook County and then somehow over his head, or somehow this was changed in some way to be statewide, and that put him in a pickle, and now he's trying to figure out what to do about that. I understand that 65% is a high threshold, and there's a reason for that. And I don't know historically. I mean, at some point in time when these statutes were put in place, there's a reason to have a high threshold, because you're asking taxpayers to foot a bill to compete with private, you know, sector enterprise. And this was a mechanism for when people were not getting served. This was an alternative scenario. But I'm very, very troubled by the fact that a vote was taken, and now after the fact when that failed, now we're coming to the legislature, or you're coming to the legislature and saying, well, the standard was too high, maybe we need to lower it. And I would like to ask a question, maybe, Senator Bach. Can you tell me, what was the vote? What was the percentage? Was it above 50% but below the 65? Is that right?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, it passed with 56% of the vote.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I mean, the statute is in place. There is a high threshold. It's for a reason. Wouldn't the efforts be better spent going to convince 9% of the voters of the wrongness of their vote and get them to change their minds that this is a good thing, rather than saying we didn't get the hurdle, so maybe we should lower the standard, and then now we can go ahead and do it? I just think that's wrong. That 65% is there for a reason.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I believe I could be wrong by a year or two on this, but I believe the 65% was put in law in 1912. Okay. I would suggest that it's not unreasonable to revisit a decision that was made in 1912. I mean, certainly the world has changed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Senator Gerlach, you want to change it from to a 65%? Is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Vickerman, I wanted to put it under the way it is under current law, to have it be at the 65%.
The reason I ask, because I've got information, they want the majority. I'm just representing people in my district.
Passed, but not by enough.
What they want to do, that's what they want to do. So, I would ask members to vote against. I hate to do that.
Okay.
Vote against you, because I have to also represent my own district. In order for them to use the money they got from the government, they'd like to have this majority. So,
is there further discussion or comment, explanation, whatever, on the Gerlach amendment to the amendment?
Madam Chair, if I could comment, I'd like
Senator Bach.
I'd like to say, if we're going to stay with a 65% threshold, we don't need the bill. All we've done is make it even more difficult, not less. So, Senator Gerlach, I love you, but I don't support your amendment.
Nobody That's wants to tape. Vote against you, it seems, Senator Gerlach, but guess what's going to happen?
Yes. Senator Vickerman's going to represent his constituents. I'm going to represent mine. And
yeah, I think that what is in the starting at line 119 on the taxpayer protections is the balance against the requiring of the lessening of the supermajority to majority. I think that, and before that, the private companies would say there was no balance, even though you may, Commissioner, may have claim otherwise in terms of what you need to go through to accomplish this kind of project under current law. Senator Roebling, on the Gerlach amendment to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would relate to how people would choose to vote, I guess, if you never get 65%. When they put their plan forward, do people know? Now, Senator Vickerman's talking about a grant that would come to help them with this project in his area. And I don't know if you were eligible for that grant as well, that federal grant. But if suppose there's no more grant money, because it's going to run out one of these days, and somebody else wants to do it, would the voters know in advance then, with the new language that was added in, or it's proposed in the Second Amendment, how much it would potentially cost them? And would it be assessed as a tax, or would it just be the people who signed up for it would be paying a higher user fee to use this to put this system in? Would that all be spelled out for voters before they went and cast their votes?
Senator Bach?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if you look at the amendment, lines 2.2 says, the ballot issue for the referendum must include, in addition to other information required by law, a statement of the maximum clauses, the maximum costs disclosed in A1 and 2 to construct, acquire, and operate. So the ballot measure would have to disclose that. So I think people would be able to see what the cost is.
Okay. Any further discussion on the Gerlach amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Gerlach amendment to the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The see, people, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted, but you have a powerful influence, Senator Gerlach.
Even Madam Chair, I understand that people don't want to vote against the tax chair sometimes, but Senator Olsen has taken it to the extreme.
We now have the Betzold amendment to Senate File 2532, the A4 amendment. Is there further discussion on the A4 amendment? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or against the this amendment, which is the bill? Come forward then. So we're on the A4 amendment. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Yes. I am Christopher Mitchell. I'm with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I had a brief comment that I was preparing to read. I think it would be useful at this time regarding this subject. A little bit about us. We're a 35-year-old nonprofit in Minneapolis. We've been working on telecom for about 5 years, recognizing that these broadband networks are crucial for communities and making sure that communities are able to succeed. I support the bill as it was entered and disagree with the amendment because as it was originally written, it lowered a significant barrier to building the telecommunications infrastructure that is needed by Minnesotans. People in rural areas have found themselves unable to enjoy modern broadband technologies because this is incredibly expensive to build, and there's not a lot of profits. Cook County is certainly not alone in fitting this profile. Just as many rural communities built their own electrical networks to ensure they could partake in the essential utility of their day, we see communities like Cook now moving forward in a similar way. The private sector is unable, and we know this, and unwilling in some cases, to build the necessary networks. Communities must already overcome a number of barriers. I'd be happy to introduce any of these to discuss them, but not all of them are needed. These networks are incredibly expensive, difficult to build and run. That's a barrier we can't get rid of, but there's no reason to introduce added barriers, like a 65% supermajority or certain portions of the clause in the amendment. The 65%, as it stands, is already a massive barrier. I hope that this bill gets rid of that. I'll skip over that as we're dealing with the amendment. Minnesotans should join the majority of states that have enacted no state barriers. There's 18 states with barriers such as the one that we're discussing, both the 65% and as well as with the amendment if it succeeds. So most states have none of these barriers. This is coming immediately after Minnesota has had a task force that's recognized the value of increasing access to these networks, so we should not be creating additional barriers to discourage the people most motivated to build them. These local governments are structurally accountable to their citizens. I follow these networks very closely around the nation. I'm familiar with the process used in creating them. The idea that a community would just willy-nilly run away and build a network without its citizens knowing is baffling to me because I have not seen it happen. Further, to the extent that we want to encourage competition in our policy, both the 65% supermajority as well as conditions in the amendment would do little to encourage that. The fact is the private sector has been unwilling to overbuild itself, even in major metropolitan cities. It is certainly never going to overbuild in a community like Cook County. And so, therefore, if we are going to prevent communities from building these networks, we will never have any competition, particularly in rural areas, giving people the benefits that we all recognize from such competition. And to urge to finish up, 100 years ago, we saw the results of expanding the private sector alone to build the electrical infrastructure. Some 90% of farms had no access as of 1935, almost 40 years after cities were getting this infrastructure. Private utilities then argued that the electricity was just too complicated for local governments, and the public sector stepped it up, and they built the networks where they were needed to make sure that all Americans had access to this important technology. And I'd like to close on the matter of specifically addressing the amendment with a quote from the Georgia Public Service Commission, which wrestled with this question of how to create a level playing field between a city, in this case Marietta, and a incumbent provider. The Georgia Public Service Commission says, "Preventing anti-competitive practices, unfair competition, and abuse of market position does not mean that the commission must impose conditions on every applicant which has some advantage not shared by every other applicant. The commission is required to treat all local exchange providers equally, not make all local exchange providers equal. Bell South and the large companies certainly enjoy better capital costs than a typical small business owner. Does this put the small company at a competitive disadvantage? Of course. Should the commission determine which local exchange provider has the highest capital costs and require that all other companies impute that amount into their rates to level the playing field? Certainly not. If Marietta has to comply with expensive open records requirements or expensive municipal building bidding requirements, should these costs be imputed into the rates of all private companies? Again, no. Similarly, if Bell South has a large tax write-off 1 year, it would be ridiculous to require that they impute into their tax rates the taxes they did not have to pay merely because some other company may not have had a large tax write-off that year." And so with that, I would just like to finish by noting a level playing field is impossible in an environment where the incumbent provider built its network decades ago under a regulated monopoly. It's amortized those costs. And that is why I believe that these conditions under the amendment are both unnecessary and harmful, and the committee should stick with the 50% majority language that it entered the committee with. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions or comments for the witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Senator Bach, did you have any response? We have the Betzold Amendment then before us. Senator Betzold renews his motion that the A4 amendment be adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have Senate File 2532 before us as amended. Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 2532 as amended be recommended to pass. And Senator Gerlach.
I have something to say, Madam Chair, before we take a vote.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I voted for the Betzold Amendment because it's an improvement over the original bill, but now I'm going to urge committee members to vote no on the bill. The 65% members is there for a reason, because it's a significant undertaking to ask taxpayers to fund something like this. And we're asking for a municipal service. It's a big deal. And 65%, a supermajority, is required for a reason, to force a consensus, not just to get a simple majority, but you want a consensus in a community. And Senator Vickerman, I dare say that, you know, that some communications you've got are from a handful of advocates that want to do this. But I would probably say that 99% of your constituents have no idea that this is even being discussed. A consensus is very important for something like this. And I would say that if 56%, 44% disagree with what's going on. And I think that there needs to be a marketing approach, a campaign, a convincing of the electorate that is going to have to foot the bill on this. And you need to arrive at that consensus. Shouldn't come to the legislature and say, just lower the threshold so we can get this through. I think that's the wrong approach. Consensus is important for something like this. This bill takes that away, and I think it's the wrong thing to do. So, members, I would strongly urge a no vote on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. We have Vickerman motion before us that the bill be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Bach.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senator Dibble, Senate File 2535.
I guess sometimes I think it should take a supermajority to increase taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2535 is a bill that addresses a similar issue to the one you just heard. It has to do with those circumstances where telephone companies are seeking to provide cable and data services. It adds just a little bit of language to our cable franchise law to clarify that municipalities can grant a franchise to a local phone company to provide cable services in their city, that the definition of more favorable or less burdensome is such that the telephone company does not have to reach into the exclusive service territories that are outside of their service territory to which they've been granted, even if that service territory is less than the full boundaries of the municipality. Madam Chair and members, as you just had a discussion, as we all know, of course, cable companies are offering data and telephone service. Telephone companies are offering cable, video, and data service, the technologies are becoming somewhat indistinguishable, and that's been a benefit to customers. Quality of service, rates, et cetera. Madam Chair, just to be clear, the proposal is that when, in fact, a telephone company is being responsive to a municipality who is seeking a proposal, then they're not going to be able to serve a subset of their exclusive territory that's within that city. Not cherry picking. They'll have to serve all their customers in their entire service territory within that municipality. But as we know, some of those service territories were set up a long time ago and have little to no relationship to existing municipal boundaries. There's some discussion about the fact that there's confusion right now because a particular telephone company in the southern suburbs was responding to municipality or request for proposals, was responsive, provided that proposal, and was interrupted in fulfilling that proposal that was granted to them because the existing incumbent cable provider filed a lawsuit. This in no way reaches back, in no way interferes with the subject that's in front of the courts right now. It's not retroactive. All the facts have been established and determined in that particular case, and that decision is going to be determined on the existing facts. As a matter of fact, facts are stipulated. It's going to be on the existing law, and so we're not reaching back. We're looking prospectively at this situation, just to clarify it. Madam Chair, I have some witnesses who can help explain a little bit better and a little bit more what we're trying to accomplish. We'll start with Frank Boyles, who's the city manager of Prior Lake.
Mr. Boyles, welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Boyles. I'm the city manager of the city of Prior Lake. Have been in that capacity. It's been my honor to do that for 17 years now. I've had the opportunity to be president of Prior Lake when the franchise was originally issued to Mediacom, and more recently, which was in 1999, and more recently in 2009, when a franchise was also issued to Integra. I want to be clear about something, though, before I conclude my brief comments here. I'm not a Mediacom basher. I'm not an Integra basher. This is not intended to attack a company in any way, shape, or form, but it's intended to identify a glitch, I think, in your current statutes, our current statutes, which are making it difficult for cities to provide competitive franchise agreements, providing for all the benefits that entails. Four quick points. One, why did the city of Prior Lake enter into a second franchise agreement? Two, where does the city of Prior Lake stand today? Three, how does this situation impact Prior Lake? And more importantly, the residents of Prior Lake, who are our customers. And finally, how does the situation apply on a broader terms, countywide and statewide? Well, we did issue a franchise to Mediacom back in 1999. Over that span of time, we have been the prime contact to Mediacom customers. We've had concerns registered with us with respect to phone and in-person service delays, et cetera, channel selection issues, and a whole host of other things. But most importantly, they complain about price escalation without necessarily the concomitant improvements that may go along with that. Well, the city can be the liaison between the customer and Mediacom, and certainly we did that. But we thought, what could we do that would be more proactive? And so what we did is we started harassing our local telecom, Integra. And so I contacted them about 3 years ago on numerous occasions, quite honestly, and said, please get into the business of Internet Protocol TV, which is in essence cable television. Well, after a number of years, they made the corporate decision to do that, and they have made many of the necessary improvements and are ready, willing, and able to provide that competitive service to Prior Lake. But that's where the glitch comes in. People can interpret our current statutes to require that the service area for all companies be the corporate limits of the community involved. And that'd be great if it could be, but I think we all know about limits of counties and that sort of things. They're by no means coterminous, and the rules that apply to the telecoms are different than the rules that apply to the cable companies. So where do we stand today? We issue a second franchise in July 2009. At that time, I asked Integra, when will you roll out the service? April 2010. We're a scant 30 days away from rolling out the service, but there is no service to roll out, because we're in the Court of Appeals, and oral arguments are scheduled for the month of March. And I'm told that if the city prevails in this case, there will be an appeal most certainly, and we'll probably be waiting, our customers will probably be waiting another year if the Supreme Court elects to hear the case. So what does that mean to Prior Lake? Well, more importantly, to our residents, to our customers, it means they have no benefits of competition. They don't get the improvements in technology, the perhaps leveling or perhaps even decrease in prices associated with competition. And from the city's perspective, Integra is one of our bigger businesses. We'd like to have them add some more employees and have a more robust economy in the circumstances we find. Finally, the customers of Integra and the customers of Mediacom and the residents of the city of Prior Lake are probably going to pay about $100,000 worth of legal fees. Now, it seems to me that that money could be better provided in improved service and competition than perhaps in litigation. To other cities and townships, I've had the opportunity to talk to my contemporaries in Scott County at least. There are seven other cities. Four of them are in a similar situation. And they tend to be risk averse. Cities tend to be that way, not surprisingly. And so what they do is they say, hey, we'll see what happens to you first. And so it is having a stifling effect on competition and multiple franchises in communities. In fact, the city of Savage, who did go to the point where they issued a franchise to Integra, has a provision in that franchise that says, hey, this kind of depends upon what happens with the litigation in the city of Prior Lake. So from the city of Prior Lake's perspective, we encourage you to adopt this language. It is not retroactive. The city of Prior Lake will have to go through the legal process, but more importantly, you're not impacting the courts. Secondly, it is very, very narrow in its focus. It's not intended to raise other issues that may be out there with respect to franchise agreements. Thank you so much for letting me testify. I'm available to answer any questions if you'd like.
Senator Dibble, I need some reassurance that this language in no way could be used by any litigant in a case currently before the courts. If it can be, then we're going to lay the bill over. Right. We don't do that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't think there's any way that any litigants can make use of this language in an existing case that's
in
front
of
the courts.
And the courts would not take any instruction from this language with regard to any litigation. Is that something you would affirm as well?
I think the arguments have been made, and the case has to be considered on the briefs that have been filed. So you know, the facts have been established. The court case is under review now. So I don't think there's any way that this is going to affect retroactively. You know, the decision is going to be made on existing language and existing facts that, that precede
Senator
this
Dibble,
day.
That, we have laws in place in the past with regards to tax cases, Best Buy, tax increment financing. The Senate, the city of Richfield, and they wanted us to change the law during the litigation, knowing full well that the courts were supposed to act on the law as it was written, but that the courts were not going to ignore the direction that the legislature was going to make a change in the way in which the dispute between the city of Richfield and Best Buy was going. I'm very uncomfortable learning that this is a response to litigation that's ongoing.
Well, Madam Chair, if it assists to establish the legislative intent in the public record, that in no way is the goal of this effort is to influence the outcome of an existing case. Madam Chair, I failed in my opening comments to recognize Senator Roebling, who's been my partner on this. This affects directly a community that she represents, and in fact, she helped present the bill in the last committee. And Senator Roebling, I don't know if you wanted to
Senator
take
Roebling,
this opportunity.
Is it your understanding that this bill would in no way be instructive for the courts or be something that the city could go into the courts to help win their case because the legislature is now changing the law?
Madam Chair, I'm not as familiar with the legal procedures as someone who is an attorney would be, but I don't know that new arguments could now be entered. I don't know if that
is the case
permissible.
Where's the case? Is it in district court, or is it in an appellate court?
It's in the Court of Appeals now, Madam Chair. The record has been made. It's been established. The decision has to be made on the established record.
But it's not before the Supreme Court now, either. It's in front of the appellate court?
All right. It's in the Court of Appeals.
And we're going to change the law midstream? Yikes. That's what I say. Yikes.
Senator
Somebody tell me I'm wrong here.
Well, I've tried, Madam Chair, so if you need someone else to tell you you're wrong.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel,
we
help me out here.
Well, and I missed part of the testimony talking about the conflict, but we try to avoid taking passing legislation that may have a direct effect on an issue that is, you know, currently in the judicial branch. We, you know, the policy is to try to wait until the courts have had their final say, and if we agree or disagree with it, then the legislature can have its opportunity to weigh in as to whether or not we agreed with that. On the other hand, there are certain kinds of cases that, for instance, you know, if you waited for all family law cases to end, you'd never get to that point. So you ultimately have to change the law at some point, and but the laws are prospective, you know, so that they are going to go into effect in the future. This bill, you know, would go into effect, you know, August 1st of 2010, you know, if passed. I don't know if, you know, we need an effective date that says, you know, that it does not affect any pending litigation. You know, I don't know if there's a – I don't remember seeing a lot of effective dates that said that, but, you know, if that would be of some comfort here. I do remember another instance, Marvin Windows. We had a special session in 1993 on that, and they were facing some lawsuits because of some, as I said, things of rotting windows or so forth, and they wanted to change the law on liability, which had an effect upon the statute of limitations and the standard in which they would be sued. So I think there were some concerns about how that was going to be done. I think we tried to fashion that would only apply to future cases, not existing cases. So we've had situations, but as I say, if we know or really have a feeling that it's going to affect something that is currently in litigation, we often back off. Senator Dibble indicated that the district court's already made its record, is now before the Court of Appeals. So does the change of law, if it's made by the legislature, would change the decision of the Court of Appeals? Actually, if it's in the Court of Appeals, they'll probably have the decision out well before August 1st. I mean, they're on a much tighter deadline than the Supreme Court that could take a year or two, you know, if they choose to. So I don't know if that helps, but, you know, as I say, and perhaps counsel can help us.
If there is that kind of language that is an instruction that this, if it's passed, not be come part of any ongoing or litigation. Current litigation. Mr. McGowan, can you
Madam Chair, I would just suggest in inserting a section to this act is effective August 1st, 2010, and does not affect any litigation pending on that date.
Senator Dibble?
That's very acceptable,
Madam
Chair.
I would feel much more comfortable with that.
I think, can't remember, I just saw similar language in a bill in front of a committee I was on. So we've done that. It's just in the last few days I've seen that language, so.
Senator Betzel?
I'll move that.
Senator Betzel moves the oral amendment that Mr. McGowan just read. Senator Roebling, did you want to comment?
I understand your concern, and if this gives us comfort, then we should probably move ahead with it.
Okay. Mr. McGowan, would you read the language one more time?
Madam Chair, members, the new language would be a new section 2 after page 1, line 23. This act is effective August 1, 2010, and does not affect any litigation pending on that date, period.
To understand the amendment, all those in favor of the Betzold Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further testimony on Senate File 2535? Senator Dibble?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have Dave Cundy from Integra who has some information.
Mr. Cundy?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Cundy, and I'm the general manager of Scott Rice Telephone Company based in Prior Lake, Minnesota. Scott Rice Telephone Company is a subsidiary of Integra Telecom and has been providing local telephone services in the Savage, Prior Lake, Elko, Newmarket, and surrounding communities for over 60 years. I'm here today to ask the legislature to make it clear that cities and other municipalities, when it comes to franchise areas for telephone companies, have the right to make that choice. They can decide a franchise area can be the whole city if they choose, or they can decide that the franchise area should be the same as the telephone company serving area if they choose. It's the city's choice. Attached in some packets that you may have is a good example of the situations that we face. There's a large map like this. On the screen, or actually in your package, you'll see that that's our service territory map. The colored blocks represent each of the cities or townships that our telephone service area touches. The red line depicts the boundaries of our service territory, as was determined by the Public Utilities Commission. These boundaries were drawn decades ago, prior to much of the development that has occurred in our area, leaving a mismatch between our service territory and all of the municipal boundaries of the communities that we serve. A few years ago, we had a discussion with Frank Broyles, city manager of Prior Lake, about the possibilities of providing competitive cable services. We researched technological advances and found that cable services, including high-definition television, can be provided effectively over a 20 to 30 megabit high-speed internet connection. We subsequently responded to the city's public notices with a proposal to offer television services to all residents within our telephone service area within the city of Prior Lake. The second page shows a map of the city of Prior Lake. It's both pink and green. That shows both telephone companies that serve that city today. Currently, the residents on the north side, that would be in the green area, have a competitive triple play option via both Quest and Mediacom, because Quest is a local telephone company there. The residents on the southern portions of the city, shown in pink, that's the Integra service area, do not have a choice for triple play offerings. They can only get that from Mediacom today. After a six-month process, Integra was awarded a cable franchise by the city of Prior Lake in June of last year. Following that, the incumbent monopoly provider, Mediacom, chose to sue the city, as we've already talked about. It is our goal to expand triple play services to our telephone customers and all of the other municipalities that you saw in our service area. These municipalities and townships are shown in the colored blocks. So this has had obviously a predictable chilling effect on our discussions with these additional municipalities and townships. We are here asking for clarification of the statute to make it clear that local governments have the authority to award franchises to telephone companies to provide video services where network infrastructure already exists. The opponents of this legislation would likely argue that telephone companies should be required to extend their network and overbuild cable companies and other telephone companies. However, it isn't economically feasible for telephone companies like mine to do so. To overbuild both Quest and MediaCom and enter into direct competition with at least two, in many cases three or four if you include satellite providers, other video providers would be financially impossible for us. When you're the third or fourth provider to enter an area, you can expect only a 10 to 20% market share. We cannot simply create a positive business case that justifies that investment in our cable plant to serve residences in these other areas of the cities where we can only expect a very small market share. The majority of incumbent monopoly cable TV companies have been providing telephone service for years. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission rules allow them to offer phone services wherever they have network right now. There were no build-out requirements placed on cable TV companies to get into the telephone business and in the internet service business. Therefore, cable TV companies have been able to offer triple play services and capabilities without having to expand their service areas. It seems only fair that telephone companies be permitted to do the same thing. I'm not asking that the legislature order municipalities to grant franchises. I'm just asking them to affirm that municipalities have the discretion to do so if they choose to do so. The last exhibit I want to show you is an example of a township that we serve, known as Credit River Township. It's the last large map in your packet. We had a public hearing in Credit River Township 2 weeks ago on a Monday night, and what we offered to Credit River Township is the ability to provide telephone service to cable television service to 85% of that township. Every place there's a green line on that map, those folks would get cable television service. Currently, the incumbent provider, which is MediaCom, only provides cable service in the orange area in the upper left-hand corner of the map, which is less than 20% of the geography.
Explain why.
The reason why, what happened was MediaCom said in the public hearing that it would be illegal for the township to grant us a franchise to serve 85% of the township of Credit River because of the way state law currently read, because we would not commit to serve all of the territory, which includes the frontier area in the gray on the side. Frontier is another territory where I do not have facilities.
But just to be clear, the reason the rest of these folks don't receive cable service, is because there's a density threshold above which cable service companies don't have to provide. So it's a per houses per mile index, and if the houses are spread out sufficiently, then the cable company does not themselves have to provide service to the entire municipality.
The point being that everybody in the white areas of this map has no cable television service today. This is an area between Prior Lake and Lakeville. Those folks have no choice. They can only get satellite service. So our offer is to bring that to 85% of the township of Credit River. That's the only option that those folks will have. Obviously, the township and its residents are very excited about that, and we're excited to bring it to them. However, the reading and the understanding of state law makes it difficult. So in summary, what I'd like to ask you to do is to support legislation that we are proposing, and these are the following reasons. Competition is good. There's minimal disruption to the public right-of-way. I don't have to tear up any streets and roads. There's an opportunity to bring cable service to thousands. We have literally thousands of unserved households in rural townships where satellite is the only option today. We're going to make private investment and create jobs, and we'll expand broadband services to a larger number of people who don't have that today. So I thank you for your consideration of this important legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Cooney. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Cooney? Mr. Grunhopper, you'll identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grunhopper, General Counsel with the League of Cities. Just three comments, really, in support of this piece of legislation. First, we feel it is a clarification of existing law. We believe that cities already have this authority. Obviously, that's the matter that's disputed in the courts. We don't think existing law requires the term more favorable or less burdensome means equal service territory. But again, that's the issue in the courts. The main point I want to make is that despite claims to the contrary, most of our communities are not getting effective cable competition. And we believe this is, frankly, the only real practical way that we're going to get effective cable competition in our communities around the state. We frankly believe this represents a reasonable accommodation requiring the telephone companies to serve their existing customer base, but certainly not allowing for any sort of redlining or anything of that sort. So because of that, we support this legislation.
Any questions or comments from Mr. Grunhofer? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to the matter before us? Seeing none, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to express support for this in particular, not only for the city of Prior Lake, but we have a number of areas that do not have cable service, and the only way they can get it is to get satellite.
Right.
They all currently have phone service and access to high-speed internet in this area. And so the availability is there for them, but because of the way the law is currently being interpreted, which I don't know if it's accurate or not, but that's being decided, the telephone companies are not able to do the area which they could very easily serve because they don't serve the whole township or the whole municipality. And so I think it, for the sake of competition, which I think we should be trying to encourage because it seems to always be better for the consumer, and it is a fairness issue. When the cable companies were able to offer telephone service, and they get to offer all three, the telephone companies weren't really able to counter that by coming back. And when they started to be able to offer all three because of new technology, and then they're still being withheld from doing that. So it is kind of a fairness issue here to me. And it also is a service issue for many people, and it isn't just in this telephone service area, but I'm sure there's many throughout the state, which is why Senator Dibble is carrying it, and it's, you know, because it could be a very well a statewide issue and help bring service, just as the Senator Bach's bill was trying to bring high-speed internet service to more areas. This is trying to bring cable services to more areas as well. So I would like to move the bill.
Yes. Senator Roebling moves that Senate file 2535 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Saltzman brings us Senate file 2716. And members, Senate File 2716 was referred and heard in the Ed Finance Committee, but it was deemed that that was an informal hearing and that the original jurisdiction for the bill is this committee. However, when the bill was being discussed in the Ed Finance Division, they did adopt, albeit informally, a delete everything amendment. But technically, since the bill had a floor motion to re-refer it to this committee to start with, and if we act on it, it will go formally to the Finance Committee and Ed Finance. We have the delete everything amendment before us, as I understand it, as an author's amendment in the Committee of Origin, because the Ed Finance Committee was not technically able to put this amendment on the bill, and the bill was withdrawn from the Committee on Finance before the Committee on Finance itself acted on it.
Correct.
And I'm stating all that for the record so that a motion from Senator Olsen to adopt the A5 amendment is adopted, is brought forward as an author's amendment. All those in favor of the Olsen motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A5 amendment is before us, and the bill is now in the shape that the author wishes us to consider it. Senator Salzman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. How much detail do you want me to go into? Just a general overview, and then I think there's a couple areas
that
this committee...
I think the general overview, and then the why the bill is appropriate for our committee. And I think we do have a... There is a summary to your delete everything amendment, and after you kind of explain it just generally, we would direct members' attention to Section 17, the Charter Schools Facilities Authority.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
What your proposals' goals are.
Very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year we passed a major charter school reform bill that really dealt with the operations of charter schools, oversight, new requirements for authorizers, and really raising the bar to make sure that our charter schools in Minnesota are successful as they can be. And in that discussion, we started to talk about charter school facilities and decided we need to have a separate discussion. And so over the interim, there were four subcommittee hearings on charter school facilities and lease aid, and really delving into the issue of the fact that we have heard from the legislative auditor back in actually 2003 that affiliated building corporations have been developed. And the legislative auditor clearly noted that it seemed that they were created to sort of circumvent current law that says that lease aid may not be used to purchase a building. And so these affiliated building corporations have been developed by charter schools, and they're sort of a pass-through, so that you could say technically lease aid isn't you being used to purchase the building because it's going through this affiliated building corporation. And that occurred for a number of years. And last year we began a process of trying to at least monitor the affiliated building corporations, but in our committee reports, in our hearings, we started looking at, and we heard from a number of charter schools, these affiliated building corporations, if charter schools could own their schools themselves directly, these affiliated building corporations really don't provide a benefit. So we began to look at something that really is a really change in policy is, you know, should we allow charter schools to buy their schools with lease aid? But as you know, that districts, when they, you know, go to build a new school, they go to their voters, and you get voter approval. When we use other kinds of state monies to build or construct buildings, we go through the bonding process, which we are all very much aware of right now. So we really tried to, you know, really meet and look at what other models are used in other states so that there is some authority that is overseeing when charter schools are building or constructing a building, should there be a threshold of how they would qualify, how lease aid should be used. The other issue that we learned through this, and there's been some newspaper stories on this, that was really something new to us, is when charter schools are using lease aid dollars and bonding, that they are using unrated bonds at a significantly higher interest rate than is obviously available to the state. So some of those findings and some of those comparisons of how much more it's costing to use these unrated bonds, it's state money. And so we started to look at, we heard from folks who came to us, and Senator Reichscott Young, who, you know, was very involved in supporting the initial charter school on legislation back, I think, in 1991-93, brought in some people who are with the Charter School Development Corporation, talked to us about the idea of credit enhancement and how might we be able to at least begin to lower these interest rates. So the bill you have before you is pretty complex. It reflects a lot of discussion of creating an authority through which charter schools that wish to purchase or construct a new building would go through. This authority would serve as essentially the conduit for these tax-free bonds. Right now, charter schools are going through perhaps a township, a city, a housing authority, some other sort of government entity that can issue the tax-free bonds, and would be able to then also, we are looking at developing a credit enhancement fund. How might we be able to create a fund that would provide some backing to, again, start to look at lowering the interest rates that currently are the only way that charter schools are able to access this kind of funding. So the parts before you, Madam Chair, I believe are on Section 17, line 19.33, where this Charter School Facilities Authority is described. And I know that Mr. Bodern has been kind enough to look at this, and I believe there may be an amendment to address some of those issues. I do want to note that this is a work in progress. We know it's a significant, it's a different idea, and we're really seeking input. We've had, early support from the charter school advocates, from the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, some of the people who have, as I call, the godmothers and godfathers of charter schools, and yet we've also had some people say, we need to address taxpayers and their comfort with the current model. So with that, I'll take questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Saltzman, okay, we are not, again, on the policy in the bill, but just in the setting up of this mm-hmm. authority. And we have noticed a couple of things with regard to the guidelines. And I've tried to be more recently, if you don't have it right when you get here, we'll lay your bill over, but I'm not going to do that, okay? But you do not have anybody convening the first meeting. You have a choice. We'll make that amendment here. It's a mm-hmm. short one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Who's your choice?
I'd like to have the amendment, Madam Chair.
No.
Do you have? Excuse me. Why don't
you
repeat?
In your bill here, mm-hmm. in terms of our guidelines, mm-hmm. you have people electing a chair, et cetera, at the first meeting, but you don't have anybody named to convene the first meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're willing to put that amendment on right now if you will tell us who you want to convene the first meeting.
It is I believe, the Commissioner of Management and Budget. Which is Finance, Commissioner of Finance.
Well, it's Management and Budget or that person's designee, I'm imagining, right?
Yes.
Mr. Bodern, do you have that? And then you have an additional amendment regarding the guidelines. Can we do that together? I mean, as a single amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman could incorporate this in her written amendment that we're distributing.
Okay.
And I apologize. That's my oversight in reviewing the bill. I didn't catch that one.
If it had been your fault, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were trying to work on this ahead of time, so I appreciate Mr. Bodern being able to add this.
Okay, so Mr. Bodern, would you explain the A6 amendment, and then we'll ask Senator Betzel to offer it on your behalf, Senator Saltzman?
The A6 amendment basically does two things. The changes you see on the top half of the amendment lines 1.3 to 1.6 make it clear who will be appointing members with certain required skill sets or experience. In the A5 amendment on page 20, lines 3 to 15, there are a variety of requirements. For example, one of the members must have a reputation for skill, knowledge, and experience in the field of school facilities finance. These changes make it clear that the governor is the one responsible for appointing those persons, and you wouldn't have perhaps conflicting requirements or responsibilities since there are other members of the authority as well, for example, the commissioner of management and budget or the commissioner's designee.
And Mr. Broughton, where would the language go for the convener of the first meeting?
Madam Chair, that can be done, I think. The best way to do that right now, on page 20 of the A5 amendment,
on line 23 after the period, you could provide a insert a sentence that says the Commissioner of Management and Budget or the Commissioner's designee shall convene the first meeting of the authority no later than, and I'm not sure what date you want to supply.
Senator Saltzman, what date would you want the first meeting to be no later than?
I would like to have it no later, I think, Madam Chair, probably of July 15th of 2010.
July 15th, 2010.
Although, Madam Chair, the bill wouldn't go into effect until August 1st of 2010.
So we wouldn't have very much time. You want to change that?
So, Madam Chair, I would move to change that to August 15th of 2010.
Madam Chair, I will point out, I think just about every section of the bill does have an immediate effective date, including Section 17, but that's...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Senator Saltzman, July 15th or August 15th?
So I will say with August 15th,
August
Madam 15th. Chair.
Okay. Do we understand the Betzold amendment as modified by the oral amendments? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Saltzman, it seems remarkably quaint to me to be talking about people with favorable reputations. Where did that language come from, as opposed to somebody just a person having skill, knowledge, and experience in the field, a person having skill, knowledge, and experience, and why do you need favorable reputation, and favorable to whom?
That's a very good question, Madam Chair. And in trying to put this bill together, we tried to look at other models that are, you know, similar in the state. And the Higher Education Facilities Authority has the same language.
And so, I would submit that language is probably decades old.
So we're trying to, again, model this off of other models so that we could make it unique to Minnesota. And so we did lift that language, and that was how it was phrased. If you have a suggestion, certainly I would be open to that.
Senator Sieben, can we take that out? Senator Sieben moves on line 20.5 to delete a favorable reputation, and on line 26, the word for. And then on line 20.7, delete a favorable reputation for. And then on line 20.9, delete a favorable reputation for. Any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. So is there further discussion on Senate file, 2716 as amended with regard to the Facilities Authority? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to comment on the bill before us with regard to the authority? Not the substance of the bill, but the authority that is created here. Mr. Kroonwitz, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Let me start by saying that we strongly commend Senator Saltzman for her work in this area, both last year and continuing forward this year. She has addressed areas that really are in need of reform, and we support the vast majority of what is in her bill. Relating to this commission, though, Madam Chair, members, or the authority, I'm sorry, what it will create is really a two-tiered system in Minnesota. You will have this new authority that is going to have the ability to approve the issuance of bonds that will be used to either buy or construct facilities for our public charter schools. At the same time, our district schools will have to still be under the process of having to conduct a referendum. In other words, going out to the voters and get it approved by their voters in their local community to do the same thing, to either purchase a building or construct a facility. So we are concerned, my members are very concerned about the uneven playing field that will be created with
the
system.
Mr. Kruenquist, would you point out the language that allows this authority to issue bonds or grant the issuance of bonds or okay. Why you have a hesitancy about the authority's authority?
Section 18.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding it's in Section 18 of the bill.
Now, I'll let you speak to that, but it is the setup of the authority that's the jurisdiction of this committee. It would seem to me that it is a finance committee's jurisdiction to determine what their powers should be, other than how their sure. their duties are explained. But you can speak about it. But I'm just we try to be very narrow because we get all these commissions, and we don't want people to avoid trying to come to this committee because they think we will deal with the policy rather than the structure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can certainly hold off until the appropriate committee, because our concern really is not to the makeup of the authority, it is to the playing field that will be created by the adoption of this authority. So I can hold off until another committee.
Okay, well, we appreciate that very much. Anybody else want to speak to Section 17 of the bill, or generally, but just briefly, Mr. Rhodes?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to section number 9, which isn't the purview of this committee, but Department of Administration.
Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair and members, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. The language
section
has
9 is
section 9.
What Mr. Rhodes is
page 14.
Speaking to page 14.
Vacant building inventory.
Okay.
Now with the delete all A5 amendment, the language has been changed so Department of Administration can live with it the way it is. So. It's speaking just for the Department of Administration. It's
okay, so that, and it was changed from the bill as originally introduced. So it may still occasion a fiscal note by this additional duty. Is that correct? From the Department of Administration?
Madam Chair, at this point, we don't think so.
You don't think so. With this language, it may not. Okay. But I think you had told me previously that the language in the original bill would have occasioned a fiscal note and an extra burden on the department.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Members, the other language would have placed a bigger burden on us without the staff. We'd have to scurry around to make it work, and that would have made a fiscal note possible. This way, I think we can probably make it work.
Which would mean then, Senator Saltzman, that the bill maybe escapes state government finance, even though it is in education finance, which is a good thing if you can work it out.
Although I always like to go to Senator Betzold's committee.
There you go.
Madam Chair, for the record, we're always happy to be before that committee as well.
Thank you very much. Okay, Senator Rowling.
I do have a question, which is kind of related to what Mr. Rhodes was just asking about. So if admin isn't going to be responsible for financing the authority, who will pay the bills for the authority? Or what kind of compensation do they need a director and that whole staffing and per diem? And who is responsible for that?
Well, just to point out that the section he was speaking to was providing that the Department of Administration was going to be charged with providing a list of vacant school buildings around the state to the authority. But Senator Saltzman, if you want to comment further, or Mr. Rhodes.
Madam Chair and Senator Rowley, you know, the vacant building inventory was that they are already doing some of this and the Department of Education would be working with them. But I think in terms of the authority, that's a discussion that we're having with the Department of Finance of Minnesota Management and Budget, that we're working on how this would be set up and that right now, as charter schools are financing buildings, there are fees and there are costs incurred. And so, you know, our charter schools are paying those fees now. We're looking at, would it be more efficient to have all of these real estate transactions funneled through one agency where they could perhaps be more efficient if a group of charter schools. We also have some language in here so that it's not a rolling application process. There would be dates established so that, unlike QComp, which is going on, you know, the applications keep going through. How can we make it more efficient? So, you know, we are working with those folks who are our bond counsel, like our bond councils, and trying to make sure that we can develop a system that is more efficient and be subsidized with fees that are already being paid now when these deals are being put together. So that is some discussion. We also could be open to looking at, could this be contracted out? So those are all questions that are being researched this week after a meeting that we had on Friday.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I know this is kind of a funding issue, too, but it said that on 22-22, the authority shall not approve the sale of bonds by a charter school if the projected facilities aid receivable is less than 84% of the principal and interest payments on the proposed debt obligation in any fiscal year. So, but if it's only 84%, would they be using their per pupil aid to make up the rest, or could they get funding from some nonprofit that's sponsoring or contributing toward them, or how did you arrive at 84%?
Right, that's an excellent question, Madam Chair and Senator Rowling. As you know, right now charter school is reimbursed 90% of the lease. So Mr. Nauman's going to perhaps explain that if you're comfortable, Madam Chair.
Very briefly, Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the
committee.
Do
my best. This is kind of steeped in school finance, but there is an assumed, under the current lease aid, that charter schools would pay 10% of their leases out of their regular per pupil formulas. And there's operating capital dollars that they receive the way normal school districts do that would be of that ilk, the kind of dollars. This one is a little bit different because in order to achieve the lower interest rates that Senator Salzman was speaking of, there's the creation of a sinking fund, if you will. It's called the Charter School Facilities Account and the Special Revenue Fund. That's equal to that 6% that we talked about in division of the payment for the bonds. So for the right to receive that better rate, 6% is taken off and put into that account, which generates an account that can be used for credit enhancement. And that's where the other 6% goes. So there's the 90% and the 6%, and the 84% are the operating percentages that we're dealing with here.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Anyone else wish to speak either in favor or in opposition to the relevant parts of Senate File 2716 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 2716 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Murphy. Senator Murphy brings us transportation powers, goals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Senate File 2540 and the sections that are in the jurisdiction of this committee are section 21 and 22. And Senator Murphy, just generally, if this is a transportation policy bill, or how would you describe this generally?
Yes, bill? Madam Chair, this is last year's policy bill that was vetoed. Chair Hornstein and myself took the governor's veto letter. We took out the things that the governor objected to, and we're running it again as is.
Okay, so this is a bill that is familiar to members of the Senate.
Right, and this provision's been in front of your committee
last
year, Madam Chair.
If we want to, we need to look at section 21, which does set up a Council on Transportation Access. And Mr. Bodern, has this section been reviewed with regard to meeting the committee's guidelines?
Madam Chair, I have looked at it, and I believe Section 21 complies with the guidelines.
Okay. Is there anyone who, let's see, Senator Gerlach's not here. Senator Roebling, you know, Senator Gerlach usually makes an amendment to have the member of the Senate who is a member of the minority party to be appointed by the minority leader rather than the subcommittee on committees. Do you want to make that amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to make that amendment.
Which amendment?
It's very common.
Which amendment?
If you look at page 16, line 19, we can go either way, but usually when the bill is in front of this committee, it would be one member of the Senate appointed by the Senate Majority Leader and one member of the Senate appointed by the Minority Leader, the same as it is done by in the it's just parallel to how the members the membership is determined in line 16, 21, and 22. It's not an unfriendly amendment, Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair?
Senator Benzel.
And we should explain. Normally, appointments are made in the Senate Rules Committee, the Subcommittee on Committees, when it comes in. But I think over the years, we've kind of looked at both ways of doing it. And when you have something like this, it clearly appoints one member of the majority, one member of the minority. Sometimes it's, you know, if you have to wait until the Rules Committee meets and the Subcommittee on Committees meets, you might have a delay in getting the appointments made. So sometimes it's just been easier to just say, fine, if you're going
to
have one majority, a minority, just let the caucus leaders make their appointments and you're done.
And generally, mm-hmm. the member of the minority is done, mm-hmm. is appointed by the majority leader, asking the minority leader, who do you want? And then the subcommittee on committees acts. And so this it's a more expedient way, efficient way of getting this group going. You have any objection?
Madam Chair, I've got a big objection, but I'll let it go.
What is your objection?
Well, Madam Chair, I kind of like the way it is in the bill, having the subcommittee on committees do it. That would be my preference, but if the committee feels the need to change it, that's fine. Go right ahead.
We've done it both ways.
Okay.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
maybe it won't apply to us after next year. And someone else will be in the minority. Then you'll probably wish it were the way we're proposing it today.
Do you want to offer the amendment, or should we let it go?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, there's always one member of the minority that is appointed. And if you look at what we do in the reporting section, and this is something that Senator Jungbauer and I changed in all the policy that comes out of the transportation bill, but we always have the reports that go to the chairs and the ranking minority members. You know, and I feel very
Senator
strongly
Murphy, that's a guideline for our committee as well.
Yeah, well, I feel very strongly that that's a good thing to do. And, you know, if you guys want to change it, go right ahead. That's fine.
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I would like to change it with just the explanation that there have been times when the Rules Committee has chosen someone other than who the minority leader would like to appoint. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the minority should be able to choose its own members for these.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I don't have a problem with that. Go right ahead.
Mr. Bodern, could you just give us the language, please?
Madam Chair, on page 16, delete lines 19 and 20 and insert a new clause that reads, clause 1, two members of the Senate, comma, one appointed by the majority leader and one appointed by the minority leader.
For heard the Roebling motion to amend. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there the other one is section 22, and this is the commuter rail corridor coordinating committee, and you're adding two people there, and since it's just one member, it's obviously entirely appropriate that the member of the Senate be appointed by the Senate Rules Committee. Is there any further discussion of the Senate File 2540,
Madam Chair,
as amended? Senator Roebling, in these two sections.
So we're still looking at?
We're looking at the sections in which there are memberships in authorities or commissions or whatever.
So
that's our only jurisdiction.
Section 21 is the Council on Transportation Access.
That's correct.
I'm just looking at the, on 17, line 13, it does provide for reimbursement for members of the council, reimbursement of expenses. I don't know if that's per diem or just actual expenses. And I know that we have, we've been forming a lot of these commissions and task force and authorities and trying to avoid any additional costs, and I'm just wondering about this one.
It actually is pretty, it's the boilerplate language, particularly when there are members of who are not members of the legislature who are part of that. Mr. Bodden, can you explain what 15059 sub 3 is?
Madam Chair, I will point out, too, this is drafted specifically. I think it was amended in the Transportation Committee to exclude the per diem payment. And the expenses are, they're somewhat limited. They're in the same manner and amount, I'm reading from the statute, as authorized by the commissioner's plan, which provides expenses for state employees.
So what does that mean, Mr. Bodden?
Let's see. Well, you'd have to look to the text of the commissioner's plan, but I believe it includes there may be a mileage component, and I think there's also child care if the meetings are held, if there are members who have to obtain it to attend the meeting. But I don't have the text of the commissioner's plan in front of me right now.
But it did not include a per diem.
That's correct.
As such. So it's I'm sure it's vouchered receipted expenses only, which seems reasonable, I think.
Madam Chair.
Just one second. Okay, I'll bring that issue up in a minute. Senator Pappas.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I don't really see any members of the public on this committee. So this just means that through their own agency budget, whatever the deal is for their agency budget for attending these meetings, they get transportation or expenses. That's all it means.
Okay. They'll get some reimbursement for expenses.
Exceeded expenses.
Okay. Right. Madam Chair, this you know, this is Senator Dibble's provision that was in the bill, and he had been working on this for about a year and a half, and then you know, people inside several different departments figured out that it was a good idea, and so they've, you know, cobbled together a group to work on this, and this just puts it in an official capacity. So
absolutely.
Yeah, this is a good thing to do, Madam Chair, and you know,
Senator Murphy, there's another issue for the Senate Rules Committee. When members of the legislature are included in groups, the bill has to go to the Rules Committee.
Oh, that's fine.
Is that okay? All right, and then it would move from there to the Finance Committee. We could do it either one way or the other, but I think probably you might want it to go to Rules first because it has legislators in it, and then move to Finance for its final disposition before your
Madam Chair,
before the Transportation Budget Division. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, if it's a policy committee, why does it have to go to Finance?
What do you mean?
If it's a policy bill. He mentioned it's a policy bill.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, there is a little bit of a cost to this bill. Mm. It's a five-figure cost. It's like $12,000 or something like that, someplace along the line. But and it's a department. It's one of the Department of Transportation's provisions, and they said not to worry about it. So they're just going to absorb the cost.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I was trying to think of a good order for this bill to go in with those
they
two
help
committees.
Us here. It came from finance. It did not come from transportation policy. I'm sorry. There's sometimes that confusion about how the committee is meeting. But Senator Betzel?
So does it have to go to the finance committee then at some point? Does it have to
we know rules? It has to go to the rules committee.
Yeah, right. But it does also have to go to the finance committee.
Only because it came from finance. Now, it went to the rules committee, and Senator Murphy does not request it to come to the finance committee and his division, then it could go from the rules committee to the floor. But we know it absolutely has to go to the rules committee.
Right. Senator Rules.
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay. Because the finance committee is going to be busy over the next 2 or 3 weeks, but in the short session, I don't know that the rules committee is going to have a lot of meetings, and I didn't want to hold the bill, you know, sitting in rules, you know, until for a month from now, and then having to move on. But if it's possible, it does not. If it can go possibly from the rules committee to the floor, then maybe the rules committee is the place to go. It just might be until after the spring break that rules committee ever gets around to doing anything. So,
Well, it meets a deadline anyway. So it. Beg pardon. It meets a deadline regardless of where, but we know it needs to go to rules.
As
it may
long as
not
it's
need
in
to
rules,
go to finance,
it pretty
right.
much makes deadline.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 2540 as amended be recommended to pass, referred to the Committee on Rules. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to try and take it out or anything, but I guess Senator Sieben's provision on the deputy registrar, I'm not quite sure why we want to take that out. That was a bad compromise about 12 years ago where we said we would allow corporations to continue as deputy registrars where you can sell your estate appointment. And I don't know why we're taking out that sunset. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I don't mind the deputy registrars being allowed to incorporate, but then being allowed to sell their public appointment, I thought was kind of offensive, but
Senator Marty, I think that would be an issue for the floor.
I know. I'm just
rather than
I'm
this
just
committee.
Saying I'm not going to take it out. I'm just saying.
We have the Olsen motion before us that Senate File 2540, as amended, be recommended to pass, referred to the Committee on Rules. Anybody want to testify on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say, aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, members.
I think we shouldn't be allowing people to sell appointments.
Where's the issue?
Yes.
Our next meeting is.
Remember that big.
Is Monday at the same time, and we will be meeting at least Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But we do not anticipate. An evening meeting if we can be efficient in the use of our time. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. With